So let's go ahead and address the proverbial elephant in the room. I guess in this case, it's a tiger in the room. You go ahead and say it. It's fine. I don't even care. I will give credit where credit is due. You guys played an excellent game. And by you guys, obviously, I don't mean you because all you did was yell at the TV. But man, how exciting was that? It was an incredible game. 7 lead changes, lots and lots of drama, and a really crappy ending. So I'll go ahead and say it. Congratulations to you guys. You got a big win. And we Bama fans got pain and suffering. That's what we walked away with, pain and suffering. And unfortunately, you're going to have to give us some grace in this because we're not used to this feeling. We don't experience it very often, especially not twice in a season. So give a little grace where we need it and just let us deal with our difficulty. If you see us crying uncontrollably and balled up in the fetal position or anything like that, you know why, you know what's going on. So there, it's addressed, it's done, it's over with. We know that we're going to be dealing with it, and now we're all good. The good news is that today we're talking about pain and suffering. So it just worked out perfectly. One way or another, one fan base was going to be, this was going to be a really applicable sermon for you. And in all seriousness, we all face enough pain and suffering that you don't need a football game to teach you about this truth. You don't need a football game to convince you that you have the emotional baggage that comes with difficulties and trials in your life. We all face it. We all run into problems that cause us pain. And we all want to know what to do to deal with that pain. 2 weeks ago, when we were in this series, letting you remember, last week we were actually over with our joint service with Seven Hills. 2 weeks ago, we continued in this series on faith and doubt. And we asked the question, what do you do when you seek an answer from God and you don't like the answer that's given? What do you do when you approach God and you pray to Him and you fervently try to find the right thing to do and He answers you and you don't like it? And we talked about that, and I feel like that was a really applicable lesson for us from the Word. And I believe today's is very, very similar, because we're going to be asking a similar question that I would guess every single person in here has some desire to know the answer to. We're going to be asking the question not about what happens when you ask God and He answers and you don't like the answer, but we're asking, like, what happens when you ask God and you decide that you're going to follow Him and things get hard? Specifically, we're asking the question, what should happen to our faith when our life gets hard? What do you do when you follow God in faith and you feel like you're on the right path and you feel like you're doing the right thing, you feel like you're doing what God wants you to do, and things aren't working out the way that you think that they should? It's not that you don't like the answer, it's just that you don't like what's happening around you. You don't like the circumstances. How do you deal with that in your life? And what does it do to your faith? Does it, you know, derail your faith? Does it make it stronger? How do you respond with your faith when life throws everything it's got at you and more? So that's what we're going to be looking at today, is this question of what should happen to our faith whenever life gets hard. I don't think I need to spend a lot of time convincing us that life does get hard. I mean, I'm not of the opinion that anybody in here thinks otherwise. Life is hard. We have difficulties in this life. I mean, you look back over your life and you don't have to look very far. You probably just have to look at this week to realize that hardships come and difficulties arise and trials are going to be there. You're going to face suffering. You're going to face persecution. Whatever synonym you want to use, every single one of us is going to face it on an ongoing basis, and we have to do something about it. We have to know how to fit that into our understanding of faith and our understanding of our relationship with the Lord. So what do we do when we decide that we're going to put our trust in God and then the bottom just gets ripped out from underneath us? When life gets hard and then it gets harder and even harder. What do we do? Today we're going to look at the book of James to find our answer. We're going to be in the very beginning of the book of James, and I love the book of James because of how practical it is. Actually, at one of my previous churches, preached an entire series through the book of James. I love it. Maybe we will do that here one day. It's one of my favorite books in the entire Bible. It's hard for me to say what my favorite one is, but this one's high on the list. And in the very opening words of the book of James, we find an answer to this question of what do we do? What should we do with our faith when life gets hard? So go ahead and turn to James. It's near the very end of your Bible. If you don't have a Bible with you, then you can look up on the screen and follow along. Let's see what James has to say about dealing with these hard times as they come. In James chapter 1, verse 2, this is what he says. He says, "Count it all joy, my brothers, when you meet trials of various kinds. For you know that the testing of your faith produces steadfastness. And let steadfastness have its full effect that you may be perfect and complete, lacking in nothing." The letter of James is pretty atypical. It's not normal when you look at the other letters that are in the New Testament. It doesn't follow some of the same like scripts that Paul does or that John does in his letters or even the author of Hebrews. You don't see some of the same statements that are being made. Like normally what you have in this is you find in James 1:1 this introduction. It's James, the brother of Jesus, and he's introducing himself to the different tribes of the dispersion, all the Jews that are scattered all over the world. And he introduces himself, and normally you would jump into, from that point, some type of like greeting that's, I'm so proud of you guys, or I'm excited about what I've heard of you, and it's almost like this compliment sandwich. We're going to get to the meat later, but we start out with a good compliment to get it, get the pump primed and get it ready. James doesn't do that. He jumps right into a command. He jumps directly into this exhortation where he says, in the very opening line, he says, this command, count it all joy when you meet trials of various kinds. Everything you face, he says, count that joy. That's the command. How on earth are we supposed to do? I mean, James doesn't understand that he's supposed to start us out with something happy. He jumps right into the difficult part. And he says, I know you're facing difficulties. I know you're facing trouble. I know you're facing these struggles and suffering. I know that's a thing in your life. Consider that joy. That stuff that's causing you problems, joy. That's what it is, and consider it all joy. And I think that it's unrealistic for us to believe that we can just kind of flip a switch in our lives and say all this suffering and all this difficulty and all these pains that we face and that are very real. I mean, we're not talking about, I had a bad day at work and therefore I'm my life is horrible. We're talking about people going through real suffering and real anguish and in all varying degrees of that. And he's saying, that right there, consider it joy. So I think it's unreasonable for us to just flip that switch and get directly to it. So what I want to do is I want to break down this passage. And I think that there are a handful of truths in this passage that really help us to get to that point where we can follow this command. Where we can say, when times get tough, I'm going to consider it joy. I'm going to consider it right. I'm going to consider it good. I think we have to really break down this passage and understand the different parts of this in order to get to that conclusion. So even though James starts with a conclusion, I feel like we need to look at these different truths that when taken together, help us to really build a full picture of how we're supposed to respond to trials. So let's look at those today. Let's take the time to actually break this down. And I want us to see a couple of truths that are very, very plain in this passage. And the first one is one that again, I don't have to convince you of. It's just pretty much assumed. It's that difficulty is a certainty in the life of any follower of Christ. It's a certainty. I mean, notice the word that is used here. It's not a possibility. It's not a probability. It's a certainty. He says, count it all joy, my brothers, when you meet trials of various kinds. Actually, in the original language of this passage, that word that's used, it leaves no room for doubt. This is an assumed thing that is going to happen. We're not talking about some like weather forecast here that there's likely going to be rain. It's not even like a 99% chance of rain. This is 100% will happen, definitely. Count it all joy when you face trials of various kinds. It's an assumed. there is a certainty that is in this passage that leaves no room for doubt. And I think that for James' readers, they would have been kind of in the same boat as we are, where you don't have to convince them of that. They were in poverty, a lot of them, most of them even. The Jews of this day had pretty much ostracized anybody who was claiming the name of Christ. They had kicked out people from their own families and said, you know what, you're not my daughter anymore. You're not my son anymore. I have nothing to do with you. Business owners were blacklisted. People weren't allowed to buy from them. If they follow Christ, then you don't buy grain from them. You buy grain from the other guy who's a good Jew. They were blacklisted, and you couldn't sell your wares anymore. Workers weren't able to find jobs because, oh, that guy follows Christ. Don't give him a job. No, they don't need to be in our lives. We don't need that kind of negativity. So no job for the people who follow Jesus. And so what's happening is you've got people that are essentially been forced into extreme poverty. And they're dispersed all over the place because now not only are they in poverty, they're being hunted and imprisoned and even murdered for following Christ. So when he writes to these first century Christians, they're not people who are unfamiliar with suffering. They knew real suffering. They knew real pain. And yet he looks at them and he says, that pain that you're feeling, that suffering that you know, those trials that are a reality, that's joy. Count that joy. He said that whatever it is that you're facing, consider that to be a joyous occasion. And it's not just James who presents this as a reality, as a certainty in the life of a Christian. Paul said in the letter to the Philippians, y'all remember we went through Philippians not long ago as a church, he said, it's been granted to me for Christ's sake, not only to believe in him, but also to suffer for his sake. So when you get to be a Christ follower, congratulations, you get Jesus, and with that, suffering. It's been granted to me not only to believe in him, but also to suffer for his sake. Jesus said, in this world, you're going to face troubles. He said, it's a certainty. He said, you're going to face persecution. It's a reality. When you follow Christ, you don't get away from this truth. I would argue it probably gets worse. It's a reality. Now, unfortunately, we've convinced ourselves that for some reason in this modern day era, we think that if you follow Jesus, all your problems will be answered, all your issues are solved. That's false. That's false gospel. That's not real. And the truth is, if you want to be a true follower of Christ, then you need to brace yourself, put your seatbelt on and buckle up, get ready, because it's coming. He says, count it all joy when you face trials of various kinds. When there is no room for any other option. And he says it should result in rejoicing. Question is how? How do we get to that point where we know that suffering is a reality? We know that. We know that trials are a certainty. So how do we get to this point where we can say that's a good thing? I think that we have to recognize what trials accomplish in our lives, and that's that trials make us stronger. That's the second truth that we kind of pull from this passage is, yes, they are a certainty, but they also make us stronger. When you face trials, something happens. I mean, he says, count it all joy, my brothers, when you meet trials of various kinds, because you know that the testing of your faith produces steadfastness. Something happens in your life when you face these trials. It produces something. You have a result that is a good result. When you face trials, why should we believe that it's joy? Why should we count it as joy? Because our trials produce something good in us. They produce steadfastness. Ultimately, what they do is they deepen our faith. Our trials make us stronger followers of Christ. That's not a truth that's easy to swallow. It's not a palatable thing. This idea that testing makes something good in us is not a fun one. This term testing or trials, the word that you've got in your translation, it actually is a pretty rare word in the New Testament, and it's almost always used of the process of refining metals. It's almost always used, when this word was used in New Testament times, it was almost always used to refer to taking a big chunk of some raw material and putting it in the fire and burning off all the dross so that what you've got left is the purity, the good stuff. And that's the word that's used here. It's a beautiful picture of how we're supposed to face these trials, the heat of the furnace, and recognize that there's a purpose behind it, that there's goodness in the difficulties that we face, that it's supposed to produce in us something good. It's intended by God to refine our faith. It heats our faith in this the crucible of difficulties, and what comes out on the other side is better than what we had before. It's less messed up. It's purer. And unfortunately for us, the process isn't fun. The process isn't an easy one, but we like to think that it should be. James wants his readers to know that the trials and the tests of this life, they're intended by God to do something in our lives. They're intended to refine our faith in such a way that what comes out on the other side is better than it ever would have been without the trials. It's better than it could have been. It produces steadfastness. And now you've got this new facet of the believer's character that is revealed through the trials. And I'll be honest with you guys, if I look at my life in a completely unbiased way, which is difficult to do, I am so much better of a follower of Christ when I'm tried than I am when times are good. If I'm being completely honest, if I am on cloud nine, it is difficult for me to follow Jesus because I'm convinced that somehow I got me there. And everything's great around me because, oh, look at my life and what all I've done. When things are great, it's easy for me to see me. But when things are difficult, it's much, much easier for me to see Jesus and to realize how much I need Jesus. When I get to the bottom of the barrel and the only place I can look is up, that's when I see the face of God in my life. That's when I see the hand of God working in my life. And unfortunately, when I'm not at the bottom of the barrel, I'm often walking around with blinders. I refuse to see his work in my life. Trials help me to be a better person, a better follower of Christ. They help me to refine my character in such a way that I'm stronger when I come out through them. I'm better because of it. It's a difficult truth, but it is absolutely a real truth. The process of testing, the metal of any believer, it helps us to be better. It helps us to follow our Lord in a better way. It's a lot like lifting weights. I've heard. I don't really know personally. If you want to talk about lifting weights, go see Devin or Rick or somebody that's actually well-built. But from what I've been told, the process of lifting weights requires that you actually break muscle before it can build. It requires that you put strain against your muscles in order to break them down so that they can regrow and build up stronger than they were before. Never experienced that personally, but it makes sense. If that's how you're supposed to build your muscle, why would we think it's any different for building our spirituality? Why would we think it's any different for building our obedience? We build through the testing, through the crushing, through the breaking. And the Lord builds us up through that. But we don't like that. It's no fun. The difference is what's produced in us. Instead of building huge muscles, what we do is we produce steadfastness. That's what it says here. I mean, look at it. It says, "For you know that the testing of your faith produces steadfastness." This is a word picture that actually is, it kind of implies the idea of a person who has carried a heavy load for a long time. It's like lifting weights. This idea that you've been able to persevere because you're able to carry on. You're stronger now than you were before. Surely when you picked it up, it felt like you'd never be able to get there. But after a while, the more you did it, the easier it became. This idea that's what is produced in the Christian through trials is its endurance. You're able to run the race better. You're able to run longer and farther and faster because of the trials. we have to remember that this idea of testing produces something good in us, even though it's painful. It's good. Now, I want you to know that when you see this, notice that the testing that's spoken of here, this is kind of just a caveat. I don't want you to feel like this is, I don't want you to walk away with the wrong idea, but the testing that's referred to is not intended to determine like whether or not we have faith. It's not intended to make you aware of whether or not you are in fact a believer. That's not the test. You don't have to pass a test in order to follow Jesus. That's not the kind of testing we're talking about here. It's not like, oh, well, if you can get through the test, then I'll let you follow me. There's nothing you can do to earn your relationship with Jesus. That's grace. It's all grace. It's by grace through faith. You can't do it. It's not of yourself. So when you see this testing, don't think that this is to get to faith. This is what happens with your faith once it's there. You don't do this. These tests don't give you new muscles. They build the ones that are already there. So when we're looking at this, I don't want you to think that, man, I'm just going to have to work really hard and work harder and harder and harder in order to earn Jesus' favor. That's not what's being said here. The fact that these trials are there is it's intended to test what's already there, the faith that you already have. And in recognizing that, you actually kind of get to another one of the truths. Because when you see that these trials have a good purpose, that tells you something kind of important about them. It tells you something important about your trials. It says that the good purpose behind these trials that you're facing, it teaches you that those trials are under somebody's control. And I'm just going to go ahead and throw this out there. It's God. If they have a purpose to them, that means there's some purposeful hand behind them. If your trials have a good end in sight, if there's something that is constantly pushing them towards this good end, the implication is somebody's doing the pushing. And that's the Lord. He is leading you to a stronger, better faith through your trials, and that implies that He's in control of even your difficulties. It implies that He's in control of even the struggles that you face. Even the hardships that you don't like, even the things that are most difficult in your life, the absolute suffering, it implies that God has a hand in controlling your life in those times. You're never out of control. Your life is never, ever out of control. It's just in His control. The implication is a strong one. It's a good one. And when trials come up, they make us better because God is making us better. It's just a great illustration of the truth of one of the most famous verses in all the Bible in Romans 8:28 says that we know that for those who love God, and all things work together for good for those who are called according to His purpose. If you love God, your life is working towards good. If God's got you, your life is headed in the direction of good. Even when you can't see it, even when you can't feel it or understand it, your life is headed in the direction of God's goodness. That is an incredible truth. Your trials are never outside of His sovereign control, ever. Let me say that again. Your trials are never, ever outside of God's sovereign control. Realize that. That's a good truth. They happen to be controlled by the one who is in charge of everything and the one who is good and loves you with everything that He is. I can't help but feel like that gives us a new perspective on our trials. If we know that they're constantly being worked out for a purpose, and that purpose is our good, it helps us to see them differently. It helps me to see my difficulties differently when I realize that my faith is tested and that testing produces steadfastness in my life. I recognize that I can look at these trials differently than I ever did before. It opens my eyes to them in a completely different way because it shows me that there's this valuable lesson in perseverance, that I'm headed somewhere. It gives me endurance so that I can get to that end goal. And the end goal isn't the endurance itself. The end goal isn't the perseverance. It's not, you know, you don't want the perseverance just for the sake of perseverance. You want the perseverance for the sake of something. And that something is spoken of in the next verse. It's that the end goal of our trials is godliness. That's where we're headed. That's the good thing that God is directing us to, is godliness, to be like him. Look at how this passage ends. He says, let steadfastness have its full effect so that you can be perfect and complete, lacking in nothing. That's the goal, so that you'll be perfect and complete, lacking nothing. It's not steadfastness for the sake of steadfastness. It's perfection that you're going after. You want to be perfect and complete. You don't lift weights just for the sake of lifting weights. I know some people enjoy it. That's fine, but you still do it for a purpose. You do it to be more like something. This picture of yourself that you have that's bigger and buffer or leaner and able to run faster or whatever. You have a goal in mind. And in this passage, the goal is godliness, to be more like Jesus. That's what we're headed for. Why is that? Because he wants his readers to be perfect and complete, lacking in nothing. And I'm going to tell you, there's only one way to achieve that. There's only one way to achieve perfection and completeness in your life. We look for it in all kinds of different places. We look for it in the stuff that we buy. We look for it in the relationships that we build. We look for it in the toys that we gather. We look for it in the statuses that we post. We look for it in the likes that we want to bring into our fold. We look for it in so many different places. We look for this idea of completion. We look for this idea of perfection. But the only place that you're going to find actual perfection, the only way that you will have everything you ever want, is when you get God. That's it. The only way that you can ever have everything is if you get God, because he is everything. He is perfection. He is completeness. He is the one being who is lacking in nothing. And if you want that in your life, you get him. And he meets those needs. It's amazing. We pray for provision, and what God gives us is more of himself. And we pray for guidance, and what he gives us is more of himself. And we pray for relief, and what he gives us is more of himself. And we pray for wisdom, and what he gives us is more of himself. He's making us complete when he does that. He's making us more and more like him. Because we look for our perfection and our completeness and our sustenance in so many different places. The only place that is actually able to continually satisfy us is the one being that is infinite. Everything else runs out. Everything else is finite. You're going to run to an end of the Facebook likes. Your vehicle is going to break down. Your house is going to crumble. Your relationships are eventually going to end. One way or another, they will. All the things in which we seek our completeness, they will stop. But God doesn't. He goes on forever. And he's the only one, he's the only being, the only thing in all of, not even creation, he's outside of creation. He's the only thing in all of existence that is complete and perfect and lacking in nothing. And that's the goal that we're headed for, is that godliness, to be more and more like him. That's why we have steadfastness. You want to be perfect and complete? You find God. You want to have a situation where you lack nothing? Have God. You might find this interesting or weird, I don't know, but I went through this kick a few years ago where I got really into poetry. And I know that y'all like, man, I thought you were a manly man, Justin. No, none of y'all thought I was a manly man. That's funny. Y'all are weird. I got really into like Christian poetry, and I found this one guy by the name of George Herbert. I was actually reading a book by John Piper called Seeing Beauty and Saying Beautifully. And in it, he outlined and kind of illustrated a couple of different lives of men of the faith. And one of the guys that he pointed to was this poet named George Herbert. And he quoted all kinds of stuff from Herbert, and in doing so, I thought, I was like, man, I really like this. This is beautiful. I like the way that he says this stuff. And so I got a complete collection of his stuff and just kind of worked my way through it. And in doing so, was floored by some of the imagery that he had and some of the ways that he was able to say things that I feel that I can't say. And I tend to be real good with words. Yeah, that was a joke. Anyway, he was much, much better at proclaiming truth in a beautiful way than I've ever been. And in doing so, I ran across some of his, like a collection of his proverbial sayings. He had this practice where if he thought of something, he would write it down kind of in this notebook that he kept. And eventually that notebook became published and was published as one of his works of poetry. And in it, there was this like tiny little poem. There was just a few short words that really hit me hard. In it, he said this is his poem. And after saying this, y'all might think, man, I can do poetry too. But he said, he loses nothing that loses not God. It doesn't matter what else you've lost. It doesn't matter what else this world takes from you in your pain and your suffering and your difficulty. If you've got God, you've lost nothing. And I know that that seems trite, and it seems almost like a pithy saying that really doesn't hold water if you look at it, you know, because we've lost things that really do matter. We've lost things that have caused huge holes in our hearts, and I recognize that truth. I'm not in any way downplaying our suffering, but eternally, when we look at it through the perspective of heaven, if you've lost not God, you've lost nothing. And I read that, and I just kind of, I highlighted it. Aaron gets mad at me because I highlight books, and when I read books, I have a pencil or a pen in my hand at all times, and she hates to come behind me and read because I often highlight a whole bunch of stuff. But this simple yet profound poem just kind of blew my mind. If you've got God, you've got everything, and if you lose something that is not God, you've lost nothing. That's what James is telling us in verse 4. He says, let steadfastness have its full effect so that you may be perfect and complete and lacking in nothing. No lack, no need, no insufficiency in your life. When you have the Lord, you've got what you need. It teaches us that the end goal of our perseverance is to understand that God is all that we need. He's everything. He is what you need in your life. Even though you think the other thing is what you need. Even though you think that other person or situation or thing is what you need. It's God. God is what you need. And this passage teaches us that. And as we understand that our sole need is God, we become more and more like Him every single day of our lives. When we recognize the truth that all we need is Him, we follow Him better and more fully and farther than we ever would without this realization. We follow Him better. The problem is that most of us don't view our trials this way. Most of us look at our trials and all we see are the difficulties. All we see is the pain and the suffering. And all we see is the stuff that we don't like. And we don't recognize that the true end of our trials is good. James wanted to remind us of that, that the goal is the preservation of our faith. It's not to derail your faith. And when you run through these trials, it's not to say, well, man, now I thought I was following the Lord and I can't believe it anymore because if I was following God, surely things would be better than this. Surely they would be better than these sufferings and trials and tribulations, if you want to throw a really cool Bible word in. All this stuff, it didn't fit into my picture. I wasn't assuming that it would be like this. And so your options are, well, I mean, I guess I can derail my faith and jump over here and just have the doubts. Or like we've talked about for several weeks now, you can overcome the doubts and press forward in your faith, stronger than you ever were before. Those are your options. I don't know about you, but for me, I want the second. We forget that our trials end in goodness, and we want what we try to do is instead of pressing through them to something stronger and something better, what we try to do is we try to get back to the way things were. We just try to get through something so that life can go back to it, how it was before, the simpler time, the good times, the good old days. And so we try to either just endure our trials in order to push them aside and get back to something that we had before, or maybe we ignore them so that we can go back to the way that things were. And if a relationship is somehow broken because of a difficulty, then our goal is to get it back to how it was. And what we forget is we're not ever able to go backwards. We can't. I mean, the Garden of Eden taught us that. We can never go back to how things were. But that doesn't mean that something good isn't waiting for us when we go forward. We can't mend everything that is broken. We can't. But we serve a God who makes all things new, different, but new. And I think that the New Testament is rife with examples of people who got that. I mean, Peter is the one that comes to mind the most fully. I mean, you're talking about a guy who looked at Jesus and said, "I'll never deny you." And then Jesus looks at him and he says in Luke 22, verse 31, he says, "Simon, Simon, behold, Satan has demanded to have you, that he might sift you like wheat." I mean, I don't know about you, but for me as a follower of Jesus, if he ever looked at me and he said, "Hey, Satan's asked for you," I'm going to need a new pair of pants after that statement. That's difficult for me to wrap my mind around. But he looks at Peter and he says, "Satan has asked to sift you like wheat." And this is what Jesus says, "But I have prayed for you that your faith may not fail, and when you have turned again, strengthen your brothers." He says, you're going to fail. You're going to ruin it. But when you do, and you realize that your faith is still there, use that to strengthen those around you. And then Peter goes on to become a pillar of the Christian faith. This guy who said, "I never knew Jesus. I never knew the man." I mean, he faced some pretty serious trials of his faith. And he failed a lot of them. But he ended up, through them, stronger than he ever was before. It's our job to realize that that's how our lives work out too when we follow the Lord in faith. If our goal is to get through the trials so that we can be stronger, not get back to the way that things were, but be stronger because of them, then Jesus is going to make us into something better. He will. That teaches us that if we start seeing trials as a means to a good end, then and only then is it possible for us to view them as occasions for joy. When you see the light at the end of the tunnel, that's when you can hold your breath long enough to get there. Then you know that this can be an occasion for joy, even though it's difficult, even though it's, I mean, quite frankly, it's called suffering for a reason. But when you start to see that good goal at the end, that's when you can start to follow James in his admonition to count it all joy. Which kind of brings us to the last statement that we have to walk away from here with, is to recognize one final truth in this passage. And that truth is that you have to choose to see your trials from this perspective. This is not natural. This is not something that comes easy and something that just is second nature to you. You have to choose to think of trials this way. Look back at the opening words of this. He says, "Count it all joy, my brothers." Your translation might say, "Consider it all joy." This is a choice. It's not something that just happens. This passage clearly tells us that the benefits of the testing come when we choose to accept them, when we choose to see them this way. And yet, for some reason, all we see are the trials. All we see is the wall in front of us. We can't see the goodness behind it. But we have to make a conscious choice. It is a conscious choice. You can't just wake up one day with this new perspective on life. One of the commentaries that I was reading on this passage, a guy named Warren Wiersbe, he put it this way. He said, "Our values determine our evaluations." He said, "If we value comfort more than character, then trials will upset us. If we value the material and the physical more than the spiritual, then we will not be able to count it all joy. If we live only for the present and forget the future, the trials will make us bitter, not better." We have to choose to see life this way. That's not natural, but it's doable. Otherwise, if it wasn't doable, I don't believe it would be in here. I mean, we have a whole slew of people who have done this before us. That's why we have passages like Hebrews 11 that we spent so much time in recently when going through Genesis. We jumped into Hebrews 11 to look at all these heroes of the faith. And then at the tail end of Hebrews 11, you get to this transition statement in Hebrews 12 that gives us the best example that we have to follow. It's not Abraham, it's not Isaac, it's not Jacob, it's not any of those people from the Old Testament. What we have, the absolute best example we have to follow, Hebrews 12, 1. Therefore, since we are surrounded by so great a cloud of witnesses, that's the chapter 11 people, let us also lay aside every weight and sin that clings so closely, and let us run with endurance the race that is set before us. How do we do that? Looking to Jesus, the founder and the perfecter of our faith, who for the joy that was set before him endured the cross, despising the shame, and is now seated at the right hand of the throne of God. And we're told by the author of Hebrews, consider him who endured from sinners such hostility against himself. Why? So that you may not grow weary or faint-hearted. So that you don't lose your faith. Follow the example of Jesus. He faced more suffering than we ever will. And he did so with his eyes on the goal. We're told to do the same. We run with endurance in the same word that's used in James, this idea of perseverance, this long-suffering. We run with endurance the race that is set before us. And we do so because we have our eyes focused on Jesus, not on our trials. I think that's how we see trials as a good thing. I think that's how we start to see our trials as something that we can consider as joyous, as good. And I know I already quoted a small poem to you, but I figured if we're going to do it, why not do it all the way out? I want to give you a longer poem by actually a missionary by the name of Amy Carmichael. Something that, to me, very much illustrates the choice that we have to make. We choose whether or not we're going to follow the example of Christ. And in doing so, we choose either all of him or none of him. We take him with everything that he has to offer, the suffering, the pain, the difficulty, and the goodness and the joy and all that's with it. Or we take none of it. Those are our options. And she illustrated this in a poem called Hast Thou No Scar. This is what she said. She said, hast thou no scar, no hidden scar on foot or side or hand? I hear thee sung as mighty in the land. I hear them hail thy bright ascendant star. Hast thou no scar? Hast thou no wound? Yet I was wounded by the archer's spent, leaned me against a tree to die and rent. By ravening beasts that compassed me, I swooned. Hast thou no wound? No wound? No scar? Yet as the master shall the servant be, and pierced are the feet that follow me. But thine are whole. Can he have followed far, who hast no wound? Or no scar. I believe that our trials are the wounds that make us like our Christ. I believe that our difficulties are the wounds and the scars that teach us to be like Jesus. And if we only see them as difficulties, then we're going to lose that fight. Our faith will be derailed and it will come to nothing. The good news is we can follow Christ. We can follow his example and we can see our difficulties for what they are. We can see them as good. And in doing so, we can count it all joy when we face trials of various kinds because we know that the testing of our faith produces steadfastness. And that steadfastness will have its full effect so that we can become perfect and complete, lacking in nothing. So as you face your trials this week, as you face your suffering and your difficulty and whatever pain you may face, whether it is as trite as a football game or as serious as a loss, you face it knowing that it produces something good in you. Would you pray with me? God, I ask that you would help us to overcome the prevalent attitude of selfishness and woe, where we constantly bemoan our problems and constantly point out our difficulties. I pray, God, that you help us to see our trials and our struggles for what they are, for something that is producing goodness in us. I pray, God, for the people in this room that I know are facing difficulty. I pray, God, that you would help them to see you in their struggles and to find you in their difficulties, God, so that they can see the end beyond them, so that they can see the goodness that this life has to offer. I pray, God, that you give us a picture of you in our trials. Just give us a little glimpse. Let us see the light at the end of the tunnel. Let us see where we're headed. Give us a picture of that preferred future. And I pray, God, that it will be enough to keep our faith strong, even through the difficulties. So help us, God, to count it all joy when we face these trials, because we know that they make us more like you. Amen.